Hello, and welcome to the Trauma Mama podcast, where we talk about what trauma is, how it happens, what it does to our brains, behaviors, and relationships, and most importantly, what we can do about it. I'm your host and Trauma Mama, Alexandra Pratt. Hey there, Thrivers. Welcome back. Instead of covering the trauma of childhood abuse, I think it's more important for me to first discuss something that's affecting the U.S. right now and has been affecting our society since it was created, and that's racism. Racism that has created the intergenerational traumatic oppression of black lives in America. It's been happening since the first black person arrived on American soil in 1619, and it's still happening today. Intergenerational trauma is caused by events that target a group of people over a long period of time, several generations, which means even family members who have not directly experienced the trauma can feel the effects of the event generations later. Intergenerational trauma is also referred to as historical trauma, and in general consists of three factors: the widespread nature, traumatic events resulting in a collective suffering, and the malicious intent of those inflicting the trauma. This form of trauma is specific, as it affects a large population and is typically more complex than individual trauma. Historical trauma can result in a greater loss of identity and meaning, which in turn may affect generations upon generations until the trauma is ingrained into society. And that is what is truly happening here in America. I would like to preface this episode with a trigger warning. I will be going into the brutal details of our history. It's difficult to hear the truth about what really happened, the stuff they don't teach us in school. And I think it's really important to fully understand the malice of our nation's founders that persists in our societal structure today. On May 25th, 2020, Minneapolis police arrested George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, after a convenience store employee called 911 and told the police that Mr. Floyd had bought cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill. 17 minutes later, after the first squad car arrived at the scene, Mr. Floyd was unconscious and pinned beneath three police officers, showing no signs of life. The police officer pinned him down with his knee for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. In the span of nearly 4 minutes, Mr. Floyd can be heard telling the police at least a dozen times that he can't breathe, and asking the officer to take his knee off of his neck. He said, "Please, I can't breathe." He called out for his mother. Meanwhile, bystanders, including the grocery clerk who initially called 911, pleaded with the officers to let Mr. Floyd get up. And sadly, the history of black Americans suffering violence at the hands of whites stretches back hundreds of years before today. In the last few weeks since the death of George Floyd, our nation and the world has broken out in hundreds of peaceful protests and marches to protest George Floyd's death, the death of countless other unarmed black lives who were killed. These protests demand justice for the murderers who wrongly took their lives. And the thing is, these protests were very peaceful until the police used force on the protesters. People shot in the head with harmful metal pellets. Crowds tear gassed. Tear gas that attacks your lungs, which was okayed by our 45th president. During a pandemic, he approved the use of tear gas that could and has had a deadly effect on those who encounter it. People were pushed, beat, arrested, all while just trying to practice their First Amendment right to peacefully protest. I went to a protest here in San Diego I know it's risky to do that during a pandemic, but it was so important for me to show up and physically be there to help keep the momentum of this incredibly crucial movement. I was blown away by the positive and inspiring energy of the crowd. By the end of the march, there was about 7,000 people. We met up with the crowd in North Park. They came down the hill on University Ave from Hillcrest. And I'll never forget that sight. Thousands of people careening down towards me. As we joined, I immediately took up screaming the chants. We took a knee just up the road from where we joined and were told instructions of how to remain peaceful and help the people around us. Then we marched for about 4.5 miles to downtown. We took over the highway, and as we went under an underpass, the crowd erupted in cheers and clapping. Such a thunderous proclamation of strength and resilience. When we got downtown, I saw someone handing out water and snacks, so I got a bottle of water and kept marching. We eventually came to a halt in front of a line of police about 2 blocks between the police and our group, and then we took another knee, and the protest leaders told us to peacefully disperse. And so we did. The devaluing of black lives and the control of black bodies are ingrained in the institutional fabric of the United States of America. It goes far beyond physical wounds. Mental and emotional wounds persist as over-policing harms black communities today. It is important for people to not sit silently. As institutionalized racism continues to wreak havoc on the health profiles of black lives in America. So what is racism? Racism has existed throughout human history. And it may be defined as the hatred of one person by another, or the belief that another person is less than human because of their skin color, language, place of birth, or customs. It has influenced wars, slavery, the formation of nations and legal codes. And race is one of the most powerful determinants of a person's life course, opportunity, and health status. That's right, race affects all of that. Things that are out of your control can get in the way of your opportunity and health because of racism. The concept of race itself is a product of a racist world. Racism makes groups of people susceptible to stereotyping, stigmatized for their cultural styles, or isolated socially. And because of this, they can experience an internalized sense of helplessness and despair, with limited access to communal networks of mutual assistance. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. This is a diagnosis typically associated with combat veterans or rape victims. But new research indicates that racism can be just as devastating. And changes in the DSM-5 open the door for a better understanding of this phenomenon. Before we dive into the repercussions of this trauma, I think we first must understand that this trauma has been happening for hundreds of years. It has not gone away. It just changes form as our nation found new and different ways to oppress black lives. While still claiming America was about liberty and freedom for all. And I think it's important that we first understand exactly what has happened, what the trauma is, before we talk about its lasting impacts and what we can do to change it. The most notorious example of racism is the enslavement of Africans in the New World, America, even though slavery itself dates back thousands of years. And this enslavement was perpetuated by the racist belief that black Africans were less fully human than white Europeans. The United States of America claimed A new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Yet, it began as a slave society. What can be rightfully called the original sin? Slavery has left a painful and traumatic imprint on our nation's soul. We had a civil war before this new democracy could be rid of that most undemocratic institution, slavery. But for Black Americans, the end of slavery was really just the beginning of their quest for equality. And even today, that is something we are still fighting for as a nation. That's what these protests are about. It's very deeply rooted in our culture, and it needs to change. You know, this racist belief was not automatic. Not always. Africans were not originally considered inferior. In fact, when Portuguese sailors first explored Africa in the 15th and 16th centuries, they came upon empires and cities as advanced as their own in Africa, and they considered Africans to be a very serious rival. What happened was, over time, African civilizations failed to match the technological advances of Europe, and the major European powers began to plunder the continent and forcibly remove its inhabitants to work as slave laborers in new colonies across the Atlantic. Africans were labeled savages and beasts. This view used to justify the slave trade at a time when Western culture had begun to promote individual rights and human equality. So, let's talk about the history of this traumatic oppression in America. So, society. It's part of ours. And society is created by a complex web of social connections and a long train of historical influences that all interact to form opportunities and shape the outlooks of the individuals in that society. Of course, individual effort is important, as is talent and sheer luck for determining how well or how poorly a person does in life. But social background, cultural affinities, and communal influence are just very significant in determining the outcome of your social status and even your health. The deeper truth is that for some four centuries now, the communal experience of the slaves and their descendants has been shaped by political, social, and economical institutions that, by any measure, must be seen as oppressive. When we look at the quote-unquote underclass culture in American cities, we are seeing a product of that oppressive history. And it is morally obtuse and scientifically naive to say that in the face of despair, violence, and self-destruction folly, that if they would just get their acts together, then we wouldn't have such a horrific problem in our cities. Acting like people in these situations choose to live like that, when in fact it's the society that constricts their ability to get out of that poverty and violence and pain to succeed at the same rate as a white person in this country. And sadly, ignorance about this issue of racism in our country is more common than you may think. Research conducted by Southern Poverty Law Center in 2017 shows that our schools are failing to teach the truth about African enslavement. Only 8% of high school seniors surveyed can identify slavery as the central cause of the Civil War. 8%. That is just mind-blowing to me. And this research also revealed that 68%, which is about two-thirds of students, didn't know that it took a constitutional amendment to formally end slavery. And fewer than one in four students, so about 22%, can correctly identify how provisions in the Constitution gave advantages to the slaveholders. How even the amendment that was supposed to free them, the 13th Amendment, still seemed to benefit white people more than it benefited black lives in America. But the truth is there, if we choose to face it. And the truth is, America was built on white supremacy. Nearly 12.5 million ancestors of black Americans were shipped as slaves from Western Africa to the Americas. The middle passage that they took to get here, typically an 8 to 12 week voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, resulted in the death of nearly 2 million of the Africans who were transported in chains. About 15% of slaves died during transport, mostly due to brutal physical treatment and suffocation in the bottom of the slave ships, inadequate health care, and unsanitary conditions, as well as through acts of resistance, such as fighting back or jumping into the Atlantic or refusing to eat. The Middle Passage started the legacy of chains that hinder the health and prosperity of black Americans today and contributes to the devaluing of black bodies. The legacy of slavery highlights how the most insidious outcomes for blacks somehow led to the most prosperous outcomes for white. While blacks were in chains and picking cotton and being whipped, many white families were acquiring land, building wealth on the backs of the enslaved. It was a deliberate, calculated, and racist decision by European settlers, and then by the U.S. government, to honor the enslavement of black lives. The first slaves arrived in America in 1619. And between 1619 and 1865, Virginia passed more than 130 slave statutes to regulate the ownership of black people. A 1662 law made all children of enslaved mothers slaves, regardless of the father's race or status, so that rape by white masters could not create a free child. A 1667 law codified that slaves who converted to Christianity were still slaves. A 1669 law allowed slaves to be killed for resisting authority. 45 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence owned slaves. That's more than half of the people who started this country owned slaves. Under the Constitution, a slave was counted as 3/5 of a free person. And 10 of the first presidents owned slaves. This is who we were as the United States became a nation. And Francis Key Scott, let's talk about him, the person who wrote our national anthem. He was an avowed white supremacist. And in fact, the third verse of the national anthem celebrates the murder of slaves. That is how some have interpreted this line. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And they just left this verse out, and we sing the first two, and that's our national anthem. It's so disappointing and shameful. In 1865, the 13th Amendment, the United States Constitution, abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, except, here's where it gets muddled, except as punishment for a crime. So basically, you could be a slave if you were a criminal. And just because the 13th Amendment came around, abolishing slavery, quote-unquote, doesn't mean that it stopped. It just began to change forms. It continues. The Southern convict leasing systems were a means of extending slavery for African Americans well past the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, and even the 13th and 14th Amendments. Convict leasing began in Alabama in 1846 and lasted until July 1928. Known as slavery by a different name, it is regarded as one of the most brutal periods of American history. Southern laws were crafted to guarantee the now, quote-unquote, free African Americans would be incarcerated at much higher rates than whites. Blacks were picked up, hauled off, and locked up for ridiculous crimes, such as being homeless or unemployed, loitering in public, speaking loudly in the company of white women, or selling farm products after dark. Whites would then profit off of these so-called convicts. Convict leasing accounted for nearly three-fourths of Alabama's state revenue in the late 1800s. As one historian describes it, the system was brutal in a social sense, but fiendishly rational in an economic sense. Once these people were in the prison system, they had effectively become slave laborers again. The state allowed convicts to be leased out to private corporations for a very, very low rate. Convict laborers were rented out at a monthly rate that represented about 50 to 80% discounted over a free laborer who would be paid to do the same job. They were forced to work in some of the most dangerous environments at the time, laying railroad, mining coal, and a significant percentage developed severe illness, injury, and died in the course of such work. It is estimated that at least 9,000 convict workers were murdered or died while working over the few decades that this system was operating. The nadir of American race relations was a period in the history of the United States from the end of the Reconstruction in 1877 through the early 20th century, when racism in the country was worse than in any other period before. During this period, African Americans lost many civil rights that were gained during the Reconstruction. Anti-black violence, lynchings, segregation, discrimination, and expressions of white supremacy increased. Because more than 80% of the nation's African Americans lived in former slave states until well into the 20th century, they had to exercise their new citizenship rights among ex-Confederates and their sons and daughters. People who are racist and have been racist for a really long time and were part of this Confederate army that fought to keep slavery during the Civil War. And although textbooks tend to portray the history of African Americans as if not much happened between 1870 and 1954, the period was actually a long war for civil rights. White Southerners continually reinvented new ways to impose white supremacy on their black neighbors. Black Southerners, in particular, fought back against this disenfranchisement and unequal treatment, the segregation and the violence that white people were bringing to their communities, the massacres, the lynchings. Because the rapidly industrializing South set up a system of racialized capitalism that left black people in segregated jobs at the bottom of the ladder, didn't give them an opportunity to really succeed in our society. Another form of forced labor was sharecropping, in which the poor black farmers theoretically received a percentage of the profits from sale of certain crop grown by them. In the early years of Reconstruction, most blacks in rural areas of the South were left without land and forced to work as laborers on large white-owned farms and plantations in order to earn a living. And many clashed with former slave masters who were bent on reestablishing a gang labor system similar to the one that prevailed under slavery. So these workers were forced to take out relatively large loans to meet these daily expenses, sharing percentage of profit with these white farm owners. And at the end of the day, many of these sharecroppers were treated just like slaves and received very little compensation for their work, besides just the basic necessities to live. And in effort to regulate the labor force and reassert white supremacy in the post-war South, former Confederate state legislators soon passed restrictive laws denying blacks legal equality or political rights and created black codes that forced former slaves to sign yearly labor contracts or be arrested and jailed. And it was very hard for them to get out of the debt and the loan that they took on with this white-owned farm. They were never set up to be able to succeed, to get out and make their own life as a free person. And then came the Jim Crow period, which was a period of an increase of lynchings and violence and massacres from 1882 to 1968. Nearly 5,000 people were lynched for organizing unions or asking for fair wages or the ability to vote. This meant that roughly one person was lynched every week. Jim Eastman in Brunswick, Tennessee, was lynched in 1887 for not allowing a white man to beat him in a fight. In 1894, Jack Brown Lee was lynched in Oxford, Alabama, for having a white man arrested for assaulting his daughter. Bird Cooper was lynched in 1908 in Claiborne Parish, Louisiana, after being acquitted of murder charges. Not only were blacks brutalized and killed, they could also not vote, gain equitable employment, or acquire wealth through government programs and aids. These acts of brutality contribute to the racial gap in morality and wealth and health that persists today. Even if a person living today was not lynched, the mental and emotional turmoil associated with the terror and fear has grave consequences. They could look at the violence that they see every day in America. Men, women, and children, unarmed, not doing anything wrong, killed in cold blood murder, right in plain sight. And the policemen get away with it. They're not charged with murder. They see these images on the news, and maybe they think, that could be my brother, my sister, my family, my friend, or it could be me. And that kind of chronic fear and stress and worry is very traumatic, and that's something that white people will never, ever understand what that's like. On May 31st and June 1st in 1921, a mob of white residents attacked the Black Wall Street in Tulsa, known as the Tulsa Race Massacre, the Black Wall Street Massacre, or the Greenwood Massacre. And it has been called the single worst incident of racial violence in American history. This happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the attack carried out on the ground from private aircraft and destroyed more than 35 square blocks of the district, at the time the wealthiest black community in the United States. And this year, this month in July, archaeologists are actually planning an excavation of the land in what they believe to be a mass grave, evidence of the worst race massacre in U.S. history. More than 1,200 homes destroyed, some 300 people dead. 10,000 people were left homeless. Yet, this act of domestic terrorism is rarely or never mentioned or taught in schools. And what America chooses to remember speaks volumes. And I think that's why it's important we have this conversation and we learn and we take responsibility for understanding the full truth. Because it's not being served up to us. And then came redlining. In the United States, redlining was the systematic denial of various services by the local government, the federal government, and even the private sector by raising prices, not allowing certain businesses to develop, and not offering the same loans or services to certain communities based on race. In the 1960s, sociologist John McKnight coined the term redlining to describe the discriminatory practice of fencing off areas where banks would avoid investing based on community demographics. And during the heyday of redlining, the areas most frequently discriminated against were Black inner city neighborhoods. In the 1980s, a Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles came out by the investigative reporter Bill Deadman and showed that banks often would lend to lower-income whites, but not middle- and upper-income Blacks. Neighborhoods with high proportions of minority residents are more likely to be redlined than other neighborhoods with similar household incomes, similar age type, and other determinants of risk. But the only difference is the racial composition. So you could have a neighborhood of low-income white or low-income Asian, and they would be given more opportunity and services than even a Black community that had more money or less money. It didn't matter. If it was Black, they were not being provided the same services as the rest of the communities. And the best examples of redlining involve denial of financial services, such as banking, as I mentioned, insurance, healthcare, and even supermarkets have been denied to residences. They'd build them super far away so that it wasn't easy for a certain community to get to, purposely locating them in practically far away places. And then, and since convict leasing, Black lives have been incarcerated at a much higher rate than any other demographic in our nation. High rates of incarceration in the 1980s and 1990s gave rise to a generation of Blacks who were locked in chains and prison cells, locked out of college and opportunity. In 2001, over 2 million people were incarcerated, and one out of three Black men in their 20s was either incarcerated, on parole, or had a previous criminal record. And this mass incarceration is another example of how controlling Black bodies led to white prosperity. For-profit prisons and investing them are very profitable. Additionally, a large percentage of Black men are incarcerated for nonviolent drug crimes. Many of these crimes are now decriminalized, and some whites are profiting off of the same drugs by making tax off of it. Weed, man, weed. And furthermore, the care and concern that America has for the opiate addiction that mostly affects white communities was nowhere to be found when Black communities were suffering with a crack cocaine epidemic. America continues to find ways to put Black people at a disadvantage and profit off of it. And instead of working to change our fundamental economic structures and mitigate the stress triggers, Our society has sought to punish black lives by placing them in environments creating unprecedented fear and stress, such as prison or a low-income neighborhood that they don't have the opportunity to really get out of. And given the amount of money and resources poured into the quote-unquote war on drugs in the U.S. over the decades, there has never been a shortage of people that can easily get sucked back up into the prison complex and become forced enslaved labor, just like convict leasing. It's still happening. Many prisons and their populations have been very costly to taxpayers, but that's the point. That's another way that white people can benefit from prisons. They can get taxes for keeping them open. They can help large corporations that build prisons, provide food and uniforms for prisons. It's all about the money. And even in our schools, black lives are being over-policed. There are numerous incidences of handcuffs and police brutality being used on black children in schools that are supposed to educate and protect them. In addition to student resource officers, some schools are allowing teachers to hold guns on school property. While guns may give some students and parents false comfort in the case of a mass shooting, black students and parents might feel differently and worry that the guns may be used on them or when their blackness is threatening. And in this regard, over-policing is not just committed by the police, but also committed by neighbors, teachers. Everything from the exclusionary practice of redlining, which segregated American cities, to the story of Ahmaud Arbery, who was killed for jogging through a white neighborhood this year in 2020. All of this contributes to a collective trauma that underwrites the black experience. And the notion of traumatic effects of enslavement being transferred to successive generations starts with the idea that slavery was not only a dreadful individual ordeal, but a cultural trauma to African American people, a syndrome which occurs when a group have been subjected to unbearable events and experiences, therefore undermining their sense of group identity, values, meaning, and purpose, their cultural worldviews, and that pain is manifested in symptoms of hopelessness, despair, and anxiety. Our nation has given little value or meaning to African American lives. They were callously tied to the capacity for labor or ability to reproduce. And moreover, their identity was literally supplied by whoever happened to own them, as though they were not even a separate identity that the ego could claim. As the eminent African American essayist W.E.B. Du Bois once said, African Americans were effectively banned from any pursuit of a cultural life through laws to prevent reading, writing, and most communal life. African Americans experience much higher rates of poverty, unemployment, and negative health outcomes compared to whites in the U.S. The intergenerational cultural trauma caused by 300 years of slavery, alongside poor economic circumstance and social prejudice, has led to the poor state of the physical, psychological, and social health among African Americans. Research shows that trauma can alter one's perception of overall safety in a society. Black people with PTSD have found to have lower expectations about the benevolence of the world than whites. When comparing black and white Americans, one study reported that African Americans held more negative perceptions of the world, appearing more skeptical and mistrustful. Research shows that incidences of diabetes, high blood pressure, premature death from heart disease and prostate cancer are generally doubled among adult African Americans compared to white Americans. African Americans also experience significantly higher psychological stress and PTSD, and these are related to depressive symptoms, poor self-rated health, functional physical limitations, and chronic illness. Similar comparisons of social health show homicide rates are higher, black men are 5 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites, which is about 5% of the African American male population, and illicit drug use and rates of intimate partner violence are highest among African Americans. And this poor state of physical, psychological, and social health demands a comprehensive response from researchers, health practitioners, policymakers, and the community. The cultural trauma experienced by African Americans over more than 300 years of their enslavement has been transmitted to the current generation and is related to their current general poor state of health. So I want to take a minute to talk about something else that contributes to this trauma, something that happens today, and that's microaggressions. Racist acts that are subtle, they're not blatant hate crimes or physical assault. It's subtle yet pervasive, and it's still an act of racism. It can be a racist joke or stereotype, a brief remark, a vague insult, a scowl, or like refusing to sit next to a black person on the subway or to change streets when you see one walking your way. These events may happen frequently, and that makes it very difficult to mentally manage that sheer volume of racial stressors. And living with those racial stressors every day is a traumatic experience in itself. The unpredictable and anxiety-provoking nature of these events, which may be dismissed by others, can lead the victims feeling as if they're going crazy, like it's all in their head. And chronic fear of these experiences may lead to constant vigilance or even paranoia, which over time may result in trauma and contribute to PTSD. And when more stressful events occur later, it could be harder to deal with it because you've had this underlying experience the whole time. In fact, one study of female veterans found that African Americans scored higher on measures of ideas of persecution and paranoia, which the authors attributed to an adaptive response to racism. While most of us can understand why a violent hate crime could be traumatizing, the traumatizing role of microaggressions can be difficult to comprehend, especially if you've never experienced it. One study of racial discrimination and psychopathology across 3 U.S. ethnic minority groups found that African Americans experienced significantly more instances of discrimination than both Asian or Hispanic Americans. And furthermore, those African Americans who experienced the most racism was significantly more likely to experience symptoms of PTSD as well. 1 in 10 black people become traumatized, and I think these rates may actually be higher since diagnostics is not always accurate in capturing and understanding trauma that's caused by racism. However, Asian and Hispanic Americans receive their unfair share of racism too, and research shows that it may even be harder to manage for individuals in these groups. But each ethnic and racial group has its own package of negative stereotypes that impact the form of racism they experience differently. So studies also show that African Americans with PTSD experience significantly more impairment due to this trauma and indicate a greater difficulty carrying out daily activities and experience increased barriers to receiving effective treatment. And research has also linked racism to a host of other problems, including serious psychological distress, physical health problems, depression, anxiety, binge drinking, and eating disorders. And I think it's important to understand that race-based stress and trauma extends beyond the direct behaviors of the prejudiced individuals. So being surrounded by constant reminders that race-related danger can occur at any time, anywhere, to anyone. Seeing clips on the nightly news of unarmed African Americans being killed in the street. Learning of these events brings up an array of painful racially charged memories and what has been termed vicarious traumatization. So even if that specific tragic news story didn't happen to that person directly, they may have had parents or aunts or friends who have had similar experiences, or know people in the community who have, and their stories have been passed down, and it affects them when they see this continuing. And over the centuries, the Black community has developed a cultural knowledge of these sort of horrific events, which then primes them for the traumatization when they hear about yet another act of violence. Another unarmed Black person has been shot by the police in our communities, and no one and nowhere feels safe. As a white person, you don't understand that fear, because you will never have to experience it, and you never have. And victims often feel powerless to stop these experiences because the discrimination is so persistent and ingrained in our society that there's no point. They feel hopeless. And those who are exposed to this type of racial oppression may turn their frustration inward, resulting in depression and disability, or respond outwardly through aggression and violence. And at the same time, they continue to remain resilient in the face of ongoing, undeserved discrimination. Within the Black community, positive coping with racism may involve faith, family, friends, forgiveness, humor, and optimism. These cultural values have allowed African Americans to be resilient and persevere for centuries, even under the most oppressive conditions. So, let's talk about trauma response in white spaces. That's something I think is very important in understanding why, in some of these situations where an African American is interacting with a cop, they panic and they run, or they try to protect themselves. And that's a symptom, or could be a symptom, of post-traumatic stress disorder related to the multi-generational oppression and what they've seen and what they know about the culture of how our police kill unarmed Black lives when they're not doing anything wrong. And even when they've done something wrong, it's such a small crime that it doesn't ever call for that type of force to be used. So, the recent killing of Richard Brooks in Atlanta is an example of how Black trauma can inform certain reactions in these white spaces. A white space being a place that's dominated by white people and where people may treat people differently because of the color of their skin. So, Brooks was questioned by two white police officers after he was found sleeping in his car in a Wendy's drive-thru. After what appeared on surveillance video to be a calm and respectful interaction between Brooks and the officers, the situation devolved into a scuffle, and as the officers moved to arrest him, Brooks hit one of the officers, grabbed the other's taser, and fired it. Then he fled, firing the taser more than once as he ran behind. And Officer Garrett Rolfe responded by shooting Brooks twice in the back, killing him. And you may ask yourself, why didn't Brooks just comply? By grabbing the taser and running, didn't he essentially cause his own death? And the answer is no. It's precisely these kinds of questions that constitute the commonplace of anti-Blackness and the lack of understanding and empathy for their experiences. And that standard argument underlies the structural racism. So, the argument that Black people fail to act in their own self-interest, therefore creating their own misfortune, is not accurate, because we don't know what it would be like to fear for your life when you see a cop. And the kind of fight, flight, freeze, or fawn mode that kicks in when you're going through a very traumatic, stressful experience like that, your body takes over into survival mode, and that survival mode looks differently because of their generational experiences with this type of oppressive trauma. So the role of empathy in the case of Brooks involves not only attempting to understand what Brooks may have been feeling in that moment that he ran, but also understanding how the reality of collective Black trauma informed that decision and affected that behavior. So I'm going to stop there. I definitely did not cover every single traumatic event of our nation's history. I just covered some of the main ones that I think are not really properly taught to our population. So I wanted to share a little bit of background about why Black Lives Matter and why it's important to keep the focus there right now, because this has been going on since the beginning, and it's not okay. So what can we do? We can stay up to date on this movement by visiting blacklivesmatter.com. We can educate ourselves, and we can take important steps to unlearn racial biases that we may have, or behaviors that we may realize now are not okay. You can read books and articles, listen to podcasts, watch shows and movies that discuss race and racism, and reflect on it, and notice it, and speak up and do something to change it. So on my website, foxinej.com, foxinejay.com, I always have a blog with information that was covered in each episode. So visit episode 8's blog for a list of where you can find resources of books and movies and shows and things you can do to help educate yourself, as well as places you can donate to help communities and families affected by police brutality. Thank you for listening. You are not alone. Keep thriving.